Professor Wilbanta is well, is a well-known philosopher of law. I think when he meets a large presentation of his community, he was working about supposedly legal positivism, and his book about this topic is, I think, one of the most important books in this topic and in this discussion, and that very important in the Spanish language discussion about this topic. This week is published another book in Spanish version. Is last book. Una teoría del control judicial de constitucionalidad basada en el common law theory judicial review.
Yes.
Okay. In our collection, in our series, in Matter Points, yesterday we discussed about it in Paris, and today in Girona, that is the program for Will is guarantee that Will will be tired together. We are very, very grateful for your visit, for your first visit, and I hope that it's only the first visit in a long series of visits. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me, Jordi. I really appreciate it, and yes, I will definitely be back if an invitation is extended. Thank you all for coming today. What I'm going to do today is essentially outline one of the basic arguments of the basic impetus behind the new book that Jordi described. So this is in a way a thumbnail sketch of the central argument in the book. Okay. Now, constitutional charters or bills of rights are often heralded, in North America at any rate, as good things to have. And for ease of exposition, I'm just going to talk about charters. And by charter, I'm going to mean any constitutional instrument like a Charter of Rights or the American Bill of Rights or the Spanish Constitution, which recognizes fundamental rights of political morality. That government action is supposed to observe. So I'm just going to use the word charter to refer to any such instrument. Now, they're generally applauded for the protections they're said to provide minorities and for their help in securing fundamental liberal democratic rights. But charters are not without their detractors. And some North American critics argue both that charters can't do the work that their advocates claim they can, and secondly, that they're morally and politically objectionable. And this morning I'd like to respond to a few of the critics' most serious objections by challenging the very conception of charters of rights and their aspirations that they and the critics and those who believe that charters are good things to have, a group that I'm going to call the advocates, seem to assume. Now, the assumption that's shared by these two groups is that many people within these two groups is that a charter represents purports to provide a stable fixed point of agreement on and pre-commitment to appropriate moral limits to government power. That's the whole point, that we can all agree in advance to these fixed points beyond of moral rights beyond which government power cannot legitimately be exercised. Now, the advocates argue not only that those kinds of stable fixed points are possible, they also contend that they're morally desirable, morally and politically desirable as well. Now, the critics, as I noted ago, challenge both of those claims. For example, they argue that the agreement and pre-commitment that's typically presupposed by the advocates' arguments cannot exist within what Jeremy Waldron calls the circumstances of politics. And by that phrase, Jeremy means, and is quoting him, the felt need among members of pluralistic societies for a common framework or decision or course of action on some matter, even in the face of disagreement about what that framework, decision, or action should be. These are what he calls the circumstances of politics. Now, that disagreement extends to the question whether to adopt a charter of rights, what rights to include within such a document, and how those rights are to be interpreted and applied in concrete cases. That's the real problem. Now, according to Waldron, and again I'm quoting him, it looks as though it's disagreement all the way down, so far as constitutional choice is concerned. Yet if the people in a pluralistic society cannot even agree on the content of the moral limits enshrined in their charters, then they can't intelligibly pre-commit to those as a stable, fixed point of constitutional limitation within which government power is supposed to be exercised on their behalf. And if they can't pre-commit in this way, then all the other benefits that are supposedly come with charters are not possible either, and we have no reason to accept one at all. Now, if that shared picture, the fixed, stable points of government limitation, if that shared picture of constitutional charters is accepted, then I believe it's pretty much game over and the critics can be declared the winners of the football match. And that's an unhappy result for those of us who'd like to believe that charters are good things to have in liberal democratic societies. So instead of tackling the critics' arguments within the framework established by that shared assumption, what I try to do in the book and what I'm going to try to do in thumbnail sketch this morning is outline some reasons for adopting an alternative framework, according to which charters do not, or at least need not, aspire to establish fixed points of agreement and pre-commitment. It's not what they're about. And importantly, they need not presuppose an unwarranted level of confidence in the correctness of our judgments about moral rights. Rather, they represent a mixture of only very modest agreement and pre-commitment, combined with a considerable measure of caution, humility, and I think ultimately wisdom. So far from being based on the dubious assumption that constitutional authors have all the right answers to the kinds of controversial issues of political morality which arise under charters, answers which they are justified in enshrining and then imposing on subsequent generations, my alternative stems from the precise opposite, from recognition that they and we do not, in fact, have all the answers to the relevant questions of political morality, and that we are wise to design our political and legal institutions in ways which are sensitive to that feature of our human predicament. Now, if we view charters in this very different light, that is, if we adopt a kind of Copernican revolution in our thinking about them, we can begin to appreciate, I think, more fully not only why charters might be good things to have, we can also see our way clear to answering the critics' most powerful arguments. At least that's what I think. That's going to be my argument this morning and in much greater detail in the book that just was published in Spanish a few days ago. Okay, so that's the next section. I'm going to outline for you what I consider to be four of the most prevalent and influential arguments that one encounters in both academic and public discourse, arguments against charters. One of the most popular arguments, and it's been with us for a long, long time, is that they are inconsistent with the fundamental tenets of democracy. Charters, after all, limits, because they're constitutionally entrenched documents, they limit choices open to legislative bodies in very significant ways. And these limits are usually enforced in many jurisdictions by unelected, and the argument goes, unaccountable, therefore, judges. But such an arrangement, it's further argued, only serves to thwart the will of the people, as that is expressed through their elected representatives. It's not enough to reply, as some judges do, and some Canadian judges have done this, that the people have themselves chosen to impose these limitations. And the reason is because quite often the limits have been imposed years and years ago, and quite often in generations ago, in the United States, well over 200 years ago. That naturally brings up the question, why should the people now be restricted in their current choices by what the people then, maybe perhaps 200 years ago, might have decided were appropriate limits to entrench in a constitution? And that's especially so given the natural bias against change which amending formulas typically build into constitutions. This all seems flatly inconsistent with the notion of ongoing self-government, which lies, it seems, at the very heart of our democratic ideals. Instead of being slaves to a king or a military dictatorship, the argument goes, we're now actually slaves to previous generations and to the unelected judges, unaccountable judges, we ask to decide fundamental questions of political morality for us. According to critics, a judicially enforced Charter of Rights represents what is, in effect, an insulting admission that we, the people now, are better off relying on earlier generations in concert with some small band of judges to make our decisions of political morality for us, to decide what the appropriate limits are. And whatever might be said in favor of such an arrangement, the argument goes, there's no denying that it's anything but democratic. It's one of Jeremy Waldron's principal arguments. Second major argument, judges as Platonic kings. The second related objection to charters is that their adoption rests on the false assumption that judges are for some reason better able than legislators and citizens who they represent to deal responsibly with the deeply complex, controversial issues of political morality and public policy which typically arise under a charter of rights. But there's absolutely no reason at all to accept this assumption, the critics contend. Judges are no better than anybody else at determining the content of those supposed fixed points of moral pre-commitment a charter represents. They might be well schooled in the law, but judges are by no stretch of the imagination moral authorities. Nor are they experts in the various fields of social policy with which government action typically deals. They certainly don't exhibit degrees of acumen superior to the levels enjoyed by the government authorities, over whose actions they are called on to sit in moral judgment. So why should they be called upon to decide the deep and difficult questions of political morality which charter cases involve? So that's the second objection. The third objection relies on the Greek story of Ulysses and his decision to be tied to the mast of his ship. In explaining the nature and appeal of charters, philosophically inclined advocates often cite this analogy with Ulysses and his decision to be bound to the mast of his ship. Much as Ulysses knows that he will become mad when he hears the sirens, we know that at some point we're going to become overwhelmed by the siren call of self-interest, prejudice, fear, hatred, or simple moral blindness, and be led, in the course of everyday politics, to violate the rights of vulnerable fellow citizens. And just as Ulysses knows that he's rationally justified in arranging in advance a restriction on his freedom to choose and act later, and this is not to diminish his autonomy in any way, it's a way of expressing his autonomy, we as a people can know that we are rationally justified in tying ourselves to the mast of entrenched charter rights and their enforcement on our behalf by judges. Okay, that's how the metaphor is supposed to work. Now, according to critics, Jeremy Waldron in particular, the radical disagreement found within the circumstances of politics undermines that analogy entirely. It just doesn't make any sense. Even if there are right answers to questions about rights of political morality, we almost never agree on what they are. As a consequence, it's sheer folly to believe that we could ever agree on what a charter's provisions actually mean and on the moral limits they supposedly impose upon government power. However, if we can't agree on the relevant limits, we can hardly rationally pre-commit to them and to their enforcement on our behalf by judges. Putting it in terms of the analogy, how can we tie ourselves to the mast of entrenched moral rights if we don't even know where the mast is? Can't even find it. Okay, so that's the third major argument in the critics' arsenal. The fourth one, Waldron makes a good deal of, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it. It's obsession with words. because after all, we're talking about a written constitutional document which purports to entrench moral rights. Another of Waldron's objections to written charters is that the words chosen to describe the appropriate moral limits to government power, and the example that's often used is the Americans' decision to use the words freedom of speech, as opposed to the arguably broader notion, freedom of expression, because there are ways of expressing yourself that don't naturally fall under the category speech, and yet there's a desire to be able to capture these other activities under that umbrella term, under speech. And this choice of speech, say, versus expression, inevitably constrains debates about rights, and it does so artificially. It thus limits our ability to respond rationally, reasonably, to changing moral views and circumstances. However, our responses could be much easier if instead we allowed our evolving understandings of moral rights and the circumstances in which they are relevant to be reflected in a more flexible, less verbally constrained, conventional understandings subscribed to the community, political community at large. Instead of relying on a written document, rely on conventional understandings which can evolve naturally as views change. In pursuing, according to Waldron, some such alternative strategy of relying on conventional understandings, we create the possibility of a public discourse less constrained by the verbal formulas and semantic obsessions of legalized politics, characteristic, he thinks, of much constitutional adjudication in the United States. And we're better able to pose the questions of moral substance that should really be our principal focus, not trying to fit new dancing, which is the example he uses, into the category of speech. So what we need, Waldron writes, are institutional mechanisms for protecting rights, which are, to quote him, free from the obsessive verbalism of a particular written document. In other words, just get rid of charters because they artificially constrain our deliberations on moral rights. Okay, so those are four of the standard arguments. Now, in each case, there are responses to be made, and some of them have been made, and I've contributed in various places to answering some of those. But instead of pursuing those arguments further, I want to focus on the shared assumption that I described at the very beginning. And I want to say something about that and how that skews the whole debate, I think. Consider now the various objections that I had outlined a minute ago. In each case, the criticism of the critics is premised on the critical assumption that charters aspire to embody these fixed points of agreement and pre-commitment, which serve then to limit government power. Now, with that unstated assumption in place, the critic goes on to argue that charters either fail to live up to their aspirations in the circumstances of politics, because we just disagree, or they're unworthy of our allegiance in a liberal democratic society. As I said, the supposed fact of radical dissensus supports the first conclusion, that charters simply can't do what the advocates claim they can. And if for some reason we stubbornly continue to believe that charters really can embody the fixed points presupposed, perhaps because we focus on factors like original intention or original understanding or something of that kind, if that's where we go in order to find these fixed points, then we're going to again be led to serious worries about their democratic pedigree and over the insulting admission we seem to be making, that we're better off leaving our most fundamental decisions of political morality to a few unaccountable judges whose role is to enforce restrictions on our democratic sovereignty, imposed, I should add, by earlier generations. So if we accept the shared assumption, I think we have more than enough reason to reject charters. But as one who is stubbornly wedded to the thought that a charter really can be a good thing to have in a liberal democratic society, continue to think that that's got to be true, I cannot help but wonder whether what we've done here is thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Whether we have will depend, I submit, on at least two factors. First, whether we accept that shared assumption. Are we going to buy into this picture? And secondly, whether the particular charter that we choose to embrace within our community and the particular practices of interpreting it that we adopt within legal practice, whether those are designed to reflect that shared assumption. What I want to do today is to show you why there's little reason to do either of those two things. Now, my argument's going to take its lead from H.L.A. Hart and his penetrating analysis in the concept of law of the costs and benefits that always come with the rule of law, an analysis to which I'd now like to turn. I'm going to just provide a thumbnail sketch of a very complex theory. Among Hart's insights was this, that we face two competing needs whenever we contemplate legal forms of social regulation. On the one hand, there's the need for general rules, or we might just say general norms, but Hart talked about rules, and I'll follow his lead here. The need for general rules, which can be easily identified in advance and readily applied without fresh judgment or weighing up of background values, policies, and so on. You've got to be able to know what the rules are and be able to apply them without much thought being given to whether one should. On the other hand, there's a distinct need to leave room at point of application of these rules, sometimes for further appeal to those kinds of factors. This is largely, Hart argued, because unforeseen situations inevitably arise, and these often bring into relief, to our awareness, issues and questions which could not possibly have been appreciated and intelligently settled in advance. Familiar factors like ignorance of fact, indeterminacy of aim, which is Hart's phrase, evolving technologies, changing social contexts, and so on, all of these things combine to create the ever-present possibility that very well-designed rules will lead, upon application in some cases, to absurd or otherwise highly undesirable results. Now, the pursuit of rules so tightly crafted that they leave at point of application absolutely no room for no wiggle room, so to speak, no room for informed judgment and discretion about whether this really is the result demanded here, that almost always represents, Hart argued, a thoroughly unworthy ideal. Fortunately, we have ways of avoiding the pitfalls of this kind of strict legal formalism, as he calls it. For example, what Hart calls the open texture of natural languages often permits some measure of the desired leeway. Now, sometimes the wiggle room left to us by open texture arises by accident, so to speak. As when a hard case just happens to fall within what Hart called the penumbra of uncertainty. And then we can seize upon that fact to decide on the merits of the particular case, and thereby amend the rule, without due concern for the letter of the law. But perhaps more importantly, and this is an underappreciated aspect, I think, of Hart's argument, open texture can also be put to use deliberately, sometimes a good thing, and in advance, in a wide range of rulemaking scenarios. In some scenarios, we can foresee that cases are very likely to arise. And we just know that the kind of situation over which our rules are to be governed are such that lots and lots of unusual cases are going to come up. They're all going to be very different. So in those scenarios, we can foresee that cases are very likely to arise in which a firm, strict, but blind recommitment to a particular legal result in all cases would have been foolish or for some reason morally problematic. Now, we can know that general fact about the scenario in which we're attempting to govern, which we're attempting to govern by way of legal rules, even though we can't foresee into the particular unwanted results that are going to come up. But we know that they're going to come up, and in great number. Now, in this kind of scenario, someone who's crafting rules, a legislator, will sometimes deliberately frame open-textured rules, incorporating terms like reasonable, fair, due consideration, and so on, the kinds of terms one often finds expressed in legal rules. Now, the rules which have those kinds of terms provide some measure of antecedent guidance, but they allow both the citizen and the judge later called upon to apply the norm to exercise critical judgment in avoiding what would otherwise be clearly undesirable results to which a more closely textured rule might have led us had the legislator instead tried to come up with a very close textured law rule. Think, for example, of tort law, the Anglo-American tort law with which I'm familiar, where the very open textured concept of reasonableness plays a central role. Now here, Hart's lessons have, I think, been well understood, if not always fully appreciated. However, those same lessons are, for the most part, I think, largely ignored in debates between critics and advocates of charters. Now, what I try to do is to rectify the theoretical deficit by feeding Hart's insights, the ones I just sketched, into the mix. And what results, I think, is a very different view about the role a charter can play for us. One which is far from being undermined by the circumstances of politics. On the contrary, charters, if they are understood in this new way, or at least some charters interpreted and applied in the right ways, can be viewed as a sensible response to the circumstances I just described. So my alternatives takes its inspiration from Hart in this basic insight. And it also takes its inspiration from an idea articulated long ago by Lord Sankey in a famous Canadian case, Edwards, which is a landmark constitutional case which was decided by the English Privy Council in 1930, even though it's a classic of Canadian jurisprudence. It was decided by the English Privy Council, which at the time was the final court of appeal in Canadian law. And that case is now commonly referred to, as I have up there, the person's case. Now, this case, Edwards, the person's case, is famous for two reasons. The first is, and this is the one that most people know about, is that it established that women are indeed persons for purposes of appointment to the Canadian Senate. Believe it or not, 1930, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that women were not persons because under common law they were not persons, and the BNA Act, which was enacted in 1867, had used the term persons and said that only persons of certain qualifications could be admitted to the Senate. And so the court in 1930 said we had to understand the BNA Act as it was understood back there in 1867. The common law understanding applied. At the time, women were not persons, therefore the BNA Act, the British North America Act, does not recognize women as persons. That's what the Canadian Supreme Court said. The English Privy Council said, come on, guys, get serious. Women are persons. And in justifying their view, they introduced this, what the living tree metaphor, which serves as my second inspiration. That living tree metaphor, which was introduced to get around this problem of being supposedly stuck with the early 1867 common law view of women, that living tree metaphor has now become almost entrenched in Canadian jurisprudence. It's repeatedly endorsed by courts, and arguably it lies behind key features of Canada's relatively new constitution and the approach the Canadian courts have typically taken to its interpretation and development. The Canadian constitution, the new constitution, was introduced in 1982. That's when we got our new Charter of Rights. Now, of particular relevance is Section 1 of that new document. It's called the Reasonable Limitations Clause, and it explicitly authorizes what are described as reasonable limitations on charter rights. But it puts conditions on these reasonable limitations. They must be prescribed by law, and they must be, quote, demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. Now, what's important here is this. What is taken to be demonstrably justified is viewed by Canadian courts as dependent on an ever-changing social, political, and legal context. On this conception, constitutionally entrenched charters don't aspire to set fixed points of agreement and pre-commitment. On the contrary, a charter is, as the Privy Council said in Edwards, a living tree. To quote it, capable of growth and expansion within its natural limits. In that respect, it's analogous to the common law of torts and its central concepts, concepts like reasonable foreseeability, due care, and so on. These evolve as cases arise and are adjudicated. Now, cast your thoughts back to Waldron's claim that with written charters, we lose, quoting him again, our ability to evolve a free and flexible discourse of politics. Well, the living tree conception of charters seeks to avoid this loss by introducing some adaptability along with stability. We have a written document which enshrines and entrenches important constitutional rights, but not in a way which attempts to fix them for good. Rather, the relevant rights are allowed to develop as contexts change and as various cases of their application arise and are publicly discussed, debated, and ultimately adjudicated in constitutional cases. Now, if that living tree option is truly is viable, and it does seem to be the option pursued for some time now in Canada, fairly successfully, I think, then our choice is not between enacting a charter or rejecting one. We can also choose the type of charter we wish to adopt and the approach we wish to take to its understanding, to its interpretation, and ultimately to its implementation. Furthermore, in choosing this living tree conception, we can reap, I think, many of the benefits for which charters are celebrated. But we can do so while at the same time avoiding most, if not all, of the potential drawbacks to which the critics rightfully draw our attention. We're going to try to have it both ways, so to speak. So treating charters as living trees provides a kind of flexibility at point of application, to come back to Hart, that allows us to accommodate the second of Hart's two fundamental needs. But what about Hart's first need for rules which can be safely applied without further appeal to background considerations? How can a living tree charter be made consistent with this fundamental requirement of the rule of law? Well, for a plausible answer, I think we again need look no further than the common law, or common law as a kind of legal reasoning. I'm going to talk about the common law, but it applies to a particular approach to legal reasoning, a case-by-case development of a system of rules as opposed to a legislative top-down approach to legal regulation. So I'm just going to call that the common law. And the common law is a system of legal regulation which seems capable of satisfying both of Hart's two requirements. Despite its well-known adaptability, it's important not to underestimate the ability of the common law to cater to the need for stability and antecedent guidance. Here's what Hart had to say on the matter. He said, notwithstanding the ability of courts to distinguish or overrule precedents and be adaptable, the result of the English system of precedent has been to produce, by its use over time, a body of rules, of which a vast number of both major and minor importance are as determinant as any statutory rule. So we talk about common law rules that arise out of this process. And they have some stickiness to use a term that Fred Schauer nicely used. Now, the degree of fixity or stickiness Hart ascribes to English common law rules has been challenged by many people, Brian Simpson in particular. And even if Hart's characterization is correct, it remains true that a common law system of regulation can pursue adaptability to a far greater extent than Hart describes. But whatever blend of fixity and adaptability the system embodies, the point remains that the common law has a long established history of more or less successfully combining those two properties. And think again of the law of torts as it's developed in Anglo-American law, say. So I think we have reason to look to the common law as a model for understanding the kind of role that a charter is capable of playing in limiting government power. And if we do so, I think we have a way of thinking about charters which allows us to avoid many of the critics' most powerful objections. We can view a charter as setting the stage for a kind of common law jurisprudence of the rights of political morality that are enshrined in it. Indeed, we can view a charter as, in effect, public acknowledgement of the following important points. sometimes acts of government, and I'm going to focus on acts of legislation because those are the simplest ones, but it applies to executive decisions as well and other sorts of decisions. Sometimes acts of government will turn out unforeseeably to infringe key rights of political morality, or so it will seem to a good many people. We can't always tell in advance when that's going to happen for the kinds of reasons that Hart describes. And for the equally important reason that we never fully grasp in advance the full nature, scope, and concrete implications of the fundamental rights of political morality that we commit ourselves to. We certainly know that acts of government will sometimes violate important rights of political morality, but we can't tell in advance exactly when and how that's going to happen. Charters, I want to suggest, can, among other things to be sure, be seen to represent public recognition of these facts and a firm promise to address these crucial moral questions when they later appear to arise in concrete instances. Charters certainly cannot fully provide in advance all the answers we seek, any more than the law of negligence always tells us in advance what we owe our neighbor in the manner of due care. But charters do, at the very least, constitute a promise to ask the right questions at the right times. That is, when it's reasonable to believe that key moral rights are being threatened by government action. Now, I'd like now to turn to some of the advantages of viewing charters this way and finish with some thoughts on how it allows us to address the critics' complaints. Okay, some of the advantages. As I noted at the outset, charters are often said to protect minorities against various majoritarian forces at play in democratic politics. It's one of the standard arguments that's given in their favor. They're thought to embody the rational pre-commitment of a community to work against those forces by tying itself and its descendants to the mast of fundamental rights which limit the valid exercise of government power. Now, we have to acknowledge that there are serious problems with that picture, and so it needs to be modified at the very least. But I think there's no reason to think that some of the essential elements can't remain in the picture. For instance, consider again the popular view that charter pre-commitment allows what in the United States is called the dead hand of the past to restrict our choices today, thus undermining the notion of ongoing self-government, previous generations still telling us how to conduct our affairs. Well, some truth remains in this point, since charters do entrench prior decisions about which rights of political morality deserve constitutional protection and entrenchment as appropriate limits on government power. And even if a kind of common law reasoning is brought to bear on how these rights are to be understood and applied in constitutional cases, the force of precedent will always have to be reckoned with. So judges deciding cases under these provisions, their precedents will always have to be dealt with on the model I'm putting forward. And as we all know, the dead hand of precedent can be as constraining as the skeletal hands of long dead constitutional authors. However, we have to bear in mind a number of countervailing considerations. First, there's the ever-present possibility of constitutional amendment. We're not stuck with a constitution. We can be amended, even though it's sometimes difficult, particularly with some constitutions, to marshal the political will and consensus to bring about an amendment. Second point, even though there's often deep disagreement about the concrete implications of the rights enshrined in a charter, there is seldom, within a community, serious disagreement, even across generations, over the importance of the rights that are actually chosen for inclusion in a particular charter. Virtually everyone in contemporary democratic societies will agree that rights to things like equality, privacy, freedom of expression, dignity, freedom of religious belief, and fundamental justice, as in Canada, those are all worthy of inclusion in the various constitutional charters one finds in the world today. A reasonable person might wish, if it were possible, to start with an entirely clean slate, for a slightly different collection of rights than those historically settled upon in his particular community, but very few people would deny the legitimacy of the choices that have been actually made in that community. So we shouldn't push the fact of disagreement too far. Third, there's no reason why a charter couldn't be designed in such a way as to mitigate the effect of entrenched decisions. I draw your attention once again to Canada Section 1, Reasonable Limitations Clause. Or better yet, think of Section 33 of the Canadian Charter, which authorizes Parliament or a provincial legislature to enact legislation which it acknowledges conflicts with a charter right. It's called the Notwithstanding Clause. It actually entitles Parliament or a provincial legislature to enact some legislation and which it acknowledges flatly violates the Constitution or certain provisions of it. And the declaration is this stands as valid law, notwithstanding. The Constitution actually authorizes Parliament to be able to do that. Now, it authorizes Parliament to enact legislation which it acknowledges conflicts with a charter right, but I think the more accurate statement is this. It enables Parliament or a provincial legislature to enact legislation which it acknowledges conflicts with the court's interpretation of a particular charter right. So that Section 33, what it does is permits the people now, through their elected legislators, to avoid for a period of time, and this must be renewed every 5 years, the Notwithstanding Act must be renewed every 5 years, a court's interpretation of the community's charter commitments. So there's a way around the court decisions built right into the Canadian Constitution. So that's another way. That's one way in which you can mitigate the effect of the tying us to the dead hand of the past. Fourth, turning now to the precedents that judicial decisions set. Though precedent is always to some degree constraining on future decision makers, and that's often a good thing, the usual common law powers of avoidance are always available to judges, were they to employ this living tree conception in deciding constitutional cases. Now, as I'm sure you all know, these powers come in an assortment of forms and with a variety of conditions under which they can be exercised, but under no sensible theory or practice of common law reasoning would a contemporary Supreme Court be completely barred from overruling a constitutional precedent, which was confidently believed to have outlived its usefulness or its moral merit. So in light of these considerations, I think we're safe in concluding that if the dead hand of the past constrains us in some way and to some degree when we adopt a charter, it doesn't have to do so in a way which seriously threatens our autonomy as a self-governing people. So, fair enough, charters can be flexible in the way that I've articulated. But perhaps we still haven't avoided the force of the critic's question. Why opt for a written charter at all? Instead, as Waldron would say, allowing public discourse, legislative debate, and judicial decisions free from the obsessive verbalisms of a particular charter to serve as our vehicle for rights protection. Why have this written document? If flexibility is so important, why not go for the most flexible option and reject written charters entirely? Well, one possible response to Waldron might be to point out that his option may not be all that more flexible. True, with charters, we're constrained to frame our debates in the abstract terms that were chosen to express the commitments that we've made. So Americans, for example, have had to discuss expressive freedom in terms of speech, not expression, and sometimes this becomes awkward. But those drawbacks can be mitigated in the various ways that I discussed a moment ago. For example, adopting a common law approach to charter development and adjudication, or by including provisions like sections 1 and 33 of the Canadian Charter. But even if those choices are not made, and the charter chosen is more absolutist in its orientation, as the American one is in principle at any rate, there are always alternative ways to achieve the desired level of flexibility. American courts have managed, in their own ways and with some awkwardness and difficulty, to come to much the same judgments about freedom of speech, including nude dancing, flag burning, etc., as they probably would have under a Bill of Rights which employed the broader term, expression. Only those obsessed with the idea that charters somehow established fixed points established by the strict or original meaning of the words actually chosen would reject the idea that it's actually the constitutionally recognized values and principles of political morality behind the linguistic expression that are ultimately of paramount importance. And in this instance, there are the political values that argue for the need to recognize a broad, though in no way unlimited, range of expressive freedoms, of which freedom of oral and written speech is only a species. In short, the words constrain, but not necessarily to the point where the underlying moral rights and values are lost sight of. And I come back to this point. If at some point the linguistic constraints become far too limiting, we can always opt for constitutional amendment. So charters need not be hampered by the need, as Waldron puts it, quote, to scramble around constructing principles out of scraps of some sacred text in a tendentious exercise of constitutional calligraphy. I love that quotation. But once again, we might reasonably ask, why run even the slightest risk of that kind of unsatisfactory constitutional practice? Why shouldn't we just abandon written charters altogether and leave it to the courts and the legislature, in response to public sentiment perhaps, to develop a flexible jurisprudence of rights within the conventional realm? Well, one important reason is that, notwithstanding the dangers of allowing words to constrain us in undesirable ways, Hart was also right when he insisted that we usually need to combine the desired flexibility with some measure of fixity that's appropriate to the context. And remember the context here. Charters are constitutional instruments whose primary role is to establish and entrench foundational rights of political morality against unwarranted exercises of government power. You have to keep remembering that fundamental role. Charters are able to solidify the limitations and commitments they represent in ways that I think are not always possible with less formal, non-written means. In part, this is due to the fact that a written charter tends to occupy a more secure place in public space than other vehicles for rights protection. Charters tend to be fairly well known, both by the general population and by the government officials over whose powers they serve to limit. Conventional understandings, on the other hand, and the unwritten rules and precedents emerging from case law can, on the other hand, be not nearly so well known. They can also be more difficult to state and grasp and more prone to controversy as to content. And arguably, for these reasons, they can often be more easily avoided and finessed by government officials bent on exercising power in unwarranted ways. When you got a charter, you can actually point to it and say, look, you violated that. A second important reason to opt for a written constitutional charter is related, is what I call its symbolic value. I think charters help define and reinforce the character of a community as one that's publicly committed in both its legal and its moral practices to the fundamental rights and values that it includes. These public commitments can, of course, be expressed in other ways, but charters, as these entrenched foundational documents that are widely known, cited, and understood as embodying the nation's fundamental moral commitments to its constituent members, I think they're a far more powerful means of expressing those commitments than most any other institutional or conventional vehicle. Ask an American, say, for one feature of the American political culture of which he is most proud, and the answer is likely going to be the Bill of Rights. And if you ask a Canadian the same question, they're going to point to the Charter. The Charter is seen in Canada not only as embodying Canada's moral commitments, the fundamental rights protection, it's seen as expressing in the particular commitments that are included there, commitments to things like multiculturalism, group rights, equality both before and under the law, and so on, an identity which distinguishes my country from many other democratic counterparts, particularly from the United States. Maybe something similar is true in Spain, I'm not sure. I'd like to know if that were the case. Now, I can well imagine a critic relying on this point by acknowledging that a charter can indeed serve this inspirational, symbolic instrument or role that I just described. I can even imagine him adding that a charter can usefully serve as the moral and conceptual framework within which public policy debates can often take place. But I suspect that he would continue to insist that I've yet said absolutely nothing to support the further conclusion that we should ask judges to enforce those charter commitments by developing this common law jurisprudence of the rights included. In other words, even if we agree to adopt a charter conceived as a living tree, we still have no reason to support the practice of judicial review, particularly of a kind which authorizes courts to overrule the informed judgments of a parliament or a national congress. We still have the question, why should we suppose that charter questions about the appropriate limits to government power are better answered by a few weathered heads in their chambers than, say, legislative bodies? Well, here are a few reasons, some of them very familiar, for thinking that we might indeed be well served by our judges in this regard. I begin by acknowledging that there's no reason in principle why judges must be assigned the task of interpreting and enforcing the abstract moral provisions of a charter. You could have a charter without judicial review. It's possible to require that Parliament or the National Congress observe its own charter limits. You could leave it to public opinion, for example, to harness them. Though for obvious reasons, this seems a bit like putting the fox in charge of the henhouse if you let Parliament observe its own limits. Another possibility is to require in any hard case in which government action is reasonably judged by a court to infringe a charter right, that the case be referred back to the enacting body for authoritative settlement. So you could actually refer these hard cases under a charter back to the legislative body for authoritative settlement. Now, there's obviously very good reason why no contemporary system, of which I'm aware, pursues that particular model, referring it back to the legislature, in dealing generally with all hard cases that arise under law, including non-constitutional ones. And that reason is hard cases in law tend to be very numerous and complex in their particularity, so much so that an already overloaded legislature would be swamped were it to assume responsibility for deciding all of these things. This is among the reasons why most political systems opt for a division of labor and normally assign the task of deciding hard cases under laws to judges. But even if that's true generally, the question naturally arises. Why shouldn't we ask our democratic legislators to decide hard cases when the question at issue concerns the charter and charter rights, constitutional rights? After all, what's at stake, as I said, are constitutional rights and values of very deep significance, and more often than not, deep political and moral controversy. Surely, the argument might go, Parliament can find the time to deal with that limited range of hard cases. Well, I'm not so sure about that. The number of cases in which, just to cite the example with which I'm most familiar, the Canadian Charter, the number of cases in which the Canadian Charter figures is enormous. Those cases include not only the landmark decisions which make the newspaper headlines and generate all the controversy, they also include in far greater number all those cases in which judges carefully and deliberately, in most cases anyway, and without much fanfare, interpret, develop, and apply the charter in deciding the many hard cases in which it is in some way relevant. Now, were all those cases returned to Parliament for authoritative settlement, I suspect that the wheels of government truly would grind to a screeching halt. So it's just not practical to refer everything back to the legislature. Yet another relevant consideration, one which is perhaps even more important than the first one, is the possibility that maybe judges are actually better situated than legislators to decide the kinds of moral questions, the kinds of questions of political morality which typically arise in charter cases. Now, I'm going to begin by acknowledging if the context of decision-making were identical, the judges were in exactly the same situation as the legislators, then I think I would be happy to agree with the critics that there's no reason to prefer the decisions of these few judges in chambers over the decisions of a much larger group of representative individuals commanding far greater resources, better able to represent in their joint deliberations the full range of reasonable views and bearing on the questions at hand. But the question is, are the decisional contexts identical? I'm not so sure. After all, there are powerful political forces working against reasonable, fair-minded decision-making in these cases by legislators. Factors like political pressure to heed the demands of a self-interested majority, or a lobby group, or a benefactor bent on ignoring or even suppressing the legitimate interests of a vulnerable individual or minority. Or think about the pressure to bow to the demands of a determined president or a prime minister wielding the immense power of party discipline. Think of all these factors at play in legislatures. These are forces to which judges are largely immune. And in most jurisdictions, they enjoy a protection that comes with life tenure and the judicial independence that brings about. And even when there's not life tenure, there is a culture of judicial independence that encourages judges to be able to make the hard calls that are politically very, very unpopular in protecting individual and minority rights. So these are fairly familiar strategic reasons for thinking that decisions about whether an act of government has violated a charter right might best be left to judges. But I think it would be a mistake to ignore the following equally important points. For reasons of practical necessity, again, legislators must always rely on the blunt instrument of general legislation. And by that I mean legislation utilizing terms which designate general classes of persons and general features of general recurring situations. Those are what we call the circumstances of rulemaking. If so, then whatever solution a legislature proposes to solve a hard case involving the alleged impact of its legislation on a charter right is likely to meet with the very same fate as the original legislation. That is, it's likely to find its way back to the legislature, where a still further attempt to map out in some canonical general terms a solution to a further hard case will have to be made. And it's not easy to imagine intelligible general legislation which could somehow sensibly cover the variety of different kinds of hard cases which have been decided under, say, the equality provisions of the Canadian Charter. Now, one celebrated virtue of the common law and its reliance on judges deciding cases and having the rules emerge from that process, one celebrated virtue of the common law is its ability, owing in part to its inherent adaptability and facility for incremental change through this case-by-case reasoning. The common law method of developing rules enables us to escape these troublesome features of general statutory regimes where rules are articulated in advance. Precedents do not represent attempts to settle issues once and for all, by way of fixed general rules. On the contrary, as we all know, a precedent is typically said to stand for the actual decision made on the issues raised. It's recognized as provisional, revisable in light of developing case law, and the many new situations brought to our attention. Through such incremental step-by-step changes, what often emerges over time is a body of law which exemplifies a level of practical rationality which statutory regimes often struggle to achieve. That, the lifeblood of the common law method of reasoning, is something which this living tree conception of charters allows and celebrates at the level of constitutional practice. That's why I want to bring it in here to this whole debate, to our understanding of charters. It may also be, I'm hazardous to suggest this, that this process is something which judges are better trained than legislators to exemplify. American philosopher Ronald Dworkin certainly thinks so, and I'm going to quote him here. He says, questions of speculative consistency, that is, questions that test a theory of rights, and we can apply this to the rights of political morality enshrined in a charter, by imagining circumstances in which that theory would produce unacceptable results, are likely to be of importance in any argument about particular rights, and they are in any charter case, because no claim of right is sound if it cannot stand the test of hypothetical counterexample. But, Dworkin adds, the technique of examining a claim of right for speculative consistency is a technique far more developed in judges than in legislators, or in the bulk of citizens who elect legislators. Now, it would be foolish to push these last points too far without a great deal more argument, and some of it I do provide in the book. But I hope I've said enough to warrant one final tentative conclusion. I think there is significant promise in the idea that a constitutional charter both can and should be designed and understood as the living tree common law model suggests. By that I mean this. A charter can be thought to represent a set of modest, reasonable commitments developed and applied over time in a case-by-case manner by judges, responsive to community sentiment on the moral right, on the questions at issue, and in partnership with other government bodies who also have their views on these important matters. Now, in stating that conclusion, I want to stress the idea of partnership. Far too often judges, and this is certainly true in Canada, judges who decide cases under a constitutional charter are criticized for claiming superior moral insight and authority as compared with legislators and the people they represent. That's one of the reasons, that's the thrust behind the judges as Platonic kings objection. But, as I hope you can see now, this doesn't have to be the case at all. The role of legislating general rules whose potential moral consequences cannot always be fully foreseen and appreciated in advance and in the abstract is fully compatible, I think, with the role invested in another body, the judges, of deciding what must be done when those potential moral consequences are brought to our attention in particular hard cases. Now, seen in that light, judges and legislators don't have to be viewed as in competition with each other over who has the better moral vision or superior authority. On the contrary, they can, and I think should, be viewed as contributing in their own distinctive ways to the achievement of a morally enlightened rule of law. If we decline to view our charters as foolish attempts to establish in advance and in the dark, as Hart might have put it, an array of fixed constraints on acts of government, and see them instead as living trees whose roots are fixed by things like precedent and the terms chosen to express the charter's moral commitments, but whose branches can be allowed to grow over time through this kind of case-by-case development of what is in effect a jurisprudence of moral rights modeled on the at the level of constitutional practice, while at the same time living up to the self-image to which all should aspire in Spain, in Canada, and in any other democratic country we find around the world today. It's the image of a self-governing, continually self-governing, autonomous people, respectful of fundamental moral rights, but fully aware that they don't have all the answers.